Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in D.C. Today, my guest is Billy Ray. He wrote the Oscar-nominated screenplay for Captain Phillips, for which he won the Writers Guild Award. His films as writer, co-writer, or writer-director include The Hunger Games, Richard Jewell, Shattered Glass, and Showtime's The Comey Rule, which had the biggest debut film of any limited series in that network's history. And he provides messaging help to 85 sitting members of the House and Senate. He believes in democracy, justice, and the Dodgers. But before we get into it, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get a bonus What's Up episode every Tuesday. It's kind of like my online journal where I get a little more personal and I talk about whatever's on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Billy Ray. Welcome to the show, Billy.
It is an honor to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's an honor to have you as a guest. And you're pretty fascinating. You have a really interesting bio. Really interesting because you're in the entertainment industry and you're also in the political realm. And we're going to get to both of them. But first, we're going to talk about the entertainment industry. And I just, you know, I did an intro and a bio, your bio at the beginning, but I'd like for you to just tell people a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up in LA.
Okay.
And I was always around the entertainment industry. The first thing I ever sold when I was 19, I sold an episode of The Jetsons.
Wow.
yes. So humble beginnings. You know, this is a really, really hard business, and mm-hmm. I've had ups and downs and, you know, the roller coaster that everyone else has had. But the last couple of years have been really good, and I've gotten my name on some movies that I'm proud of. And I feel like I'm making a contribution to the culture, which is important to me.
Yes, that's really, really cool. And oh my God, I mean, you wrote The Comey Rule. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And you were Oscar nominated for the screenplay Captain Phillips. That's amazing. Richard Jewell was awesome. I have not watched The Hunger Games, and you know, please don't take that personally. It's just a little too intense for me. So it's too intense for me. Were you ever on set as they were filming?
Not on The Hunger Games, no.
Okay.
You know, the thing is, you know, I've directed a number of times, including The Comey Rule. But when you're the writer of something that you don't direct, you have to think of it like a relay race. You run your lap and you hand off the baton to the director. And at that point, you can follow the director around the track if you want, but you can't really change the way he or she is going to run their lap. So you better get pretty sanguine with that. You know, Clint Eastwood didn't need me on the set of Richard Jewell, and Paul Greengrass didn't need me on the set of Captain Phillips. They were just fine without me. and it turns out, you know, Gary Ross, when he was making The Hunger Games, he was making that his movie, which he should. He's the director.
Wow. That's just really
but
cool.
But I will tell you, though, among all of those, by far the most viewed thing I've ever written in my life, and it's not close, is the AMC ad starring Nicole Kidman that plays in front of all AMC, all feature attractions. Wow. That's been viewed by 400 million people wow. in theaters alone.
That's crazy. That's yep. just insane. Well, if you ever need a really good story screenplay about a female serial killer, let me know.
Okay, thank you.
That's all I know. I know everybody in the industry is like, yeah. Everybody's got a freaking screenplay. But, you know, this is just my little way of throwing it out there. Okay.
Does that mean that you are actually a serial killer?
Actually, I am not actually a serial killer, but oh. there is a book written loosely based on me, and a serial killer was after me. But it really isn't. It's not really me. And there's actually some humor in it. It's really cool. But anyway, I mean, this is not about that story. So I just, of course, I have to throw it out there. So, you know, I lived in Hollywood myself. I moved to Los Angeles when I was 9. I was originally wow. from Maryland, and mm-hmm. my mother took us out there. And then I was there until 2009, although I did live in Russia for a brief period of time because my dad worked for ABC News, so I had that going. That's when I was 12. God. Yeah, 1981. But I basically lived in Los Angeles up until 2009. Then I went to Northern California, and now I'm back in the DC area. So I do miss Los Angeles.
It sounds like your life has been a lot more interesting than mine. Maybe I should be interviewing you.
Not necessarily, but I have had an interesting life, and I'm extremely grateful because I think that my mother gave me the opportunity to experience so many different ways of being. You know, I got to experience that, like, the Maryland way of being, and there's, like, more traditional vibes going on here, and then I got California, I got to go to Russia, I got to have these experiences. So, yeah, I'm really grateful, but I think it helps me to talk to people like you who have been wildly successful in your career, because I did pursue an acting career, as I told you when we were emailing each other. I yeah. obviously never became as successful as you, but it was an amazing experience. It was a little over 10 years. But again, mm-hmm. that's just about me. I don't want to talk about me. I want to talk about you. And so I wanted to know, right now, are there any new projects that you're working on?
There are a few.
That you can talk about. Yeah.
Sure. There's a movie that I'm writing for Netflix. It's the first time I've ever adapted a comic book, and I'm having a lot of fun with that. And that's for Michael B. Jordan to star in. And there's a movie that I wrote that it looks like Robert Zemeckis is going to direct.
Awesome.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And a couple other things that are bouncing around that all seem like they have a reasonable shot of going. And two or three TV projects. So there's plenty
wow.
to do.
Wow. Yeah, you're very busy.
And in the midst of that, the political work I'm doing, which is the unpaid half of my day.
Yeah. And we're definitely going to get into that. But first, I want to ask you something. I'm not going to get too much into this, but I do a patrons only show where I talk about intentional manifesting. And since you're a creative person who's clearly been successful, do you apply any kind of intentional manifesting to your work? Like, do you visualize it before it happens? Do you have any kind of like mantras or affirmations that you say as you're working, or is this just totally, you know, you're doing your thing and that's it?
It's not really a mantra. It's a mindset. Mm-hmm. And the mindset is just outwork everybody else. It's just out hustle everybody else. I'm not more talented than the people that I'm competing with, but I'm more willing to work hard than they are.
Right.
And I don't think my first drafts are necessarily better than anybody else's. I think where I've separated myself is that when you're on the 14th draft and every other writer is getting distracted and pissed off and bitter, I'm still approaching it like it's my first draft with the same level of energy.
Hmm.
So that to me is the mantra. Mm-hmm. I don't visualize it. I just do it. Mm-hmm. I just get up and I grind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know another way.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I'm so into the idea of like, you know, we create our own life. Obviously, there are things that happen in our lives that we aren't creating. And then it just is all about how we react to those things. But I'm so into that.
Well, okay, so if you want a visualization, mm-hmm. Here's one
okay.
that works for me. Picture an old hot air balloon, like the one that Judy Garland was in at the end of The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the balloon part is your confidence, your belief in yourself, which is what keeps the balloon in the air.
Yeah.
If that becomes ego, if you become the person who says, I am such a genius that I don't need help from anybody. I don't need to take anybody's notes. I'm not open to criticism. Mm-hmm. Then the balloon goes flying off into the stratosphere, never to be heard from again.
Yeah.
In the basket is your humility, your understanding, at least for me, that I am not a genius and that I need help, that this is the most collaborative art form in the history of the world. Hmm. And I need input from other people who have other experiences and other perspectives. But if that basket, instead of becoming humility, becomes self-doubt, mm-hmm. the thing can't get off the ground.
Wow.
So the balance that you're trying to achieve yeah. is between confidence and humility. In other words, having the confidence to say, I don't understand how this works. Can you help me? Mm-hmm. If you can balance those things out, confidence and humility, they're not competing virtues at all. They actually feed one another. And if you have the proper ratio of one to the other, the thing stays in the air, not just for one movie or two movies, but for 30 years, for a career,
yeah.
which is what you're trying to do.
That's, I love that. That's wonderful. I want to write that down.
You're welcome to it.
So thank you. Okay, well, let's move over into...
One other thing before we go to politics.
Sure.
One other thing. It's true that it is a really hard business, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. But it's also true that there's no one in the world, and this is true of every single person who's listening, there's no one in the world that has... your history, mm-hmm. your talent, mm-hmm. your voice, your pain, your humor, your insight. No one but you has that particular yes. bunch of arrows in their quiver. Mm-hmm. And there are screenplays that you can write or that someone who's working in a diamond mine can write that I can't write just mm-hmm. by virtue of not being them. Mm-hmm. And every time the business tells you to be more like other writers... Instead, just be more like you.
Yeah.
Be more true to the thing that makes you unique and singular. That's the voice that will actually give you a career.
You know what? It's so fascinating that you say that, because when I was pursuing an acting career, initially I just had the assumption that I would be successful. I did believe that I was a good actor. I knew that I was funny. I knew that I could do it. But slowly... the industry made, and I can't, yeah, I can. The industry made me feel insecure about my physical appearance because I'm tall and I'm like a broad shouldered, big boned woman. I was slender, but it didn't matter because, you know, the women back in the 90s were size zero and I was a size 10. And so what you just said, the doubt crept in. Even though I had confidence in what I was doing, you know, as far as, you know, if I had a audition or if I was going to be actually, you know, doing a role, I had confidence in myself there, but I didn't have confidence in myself because of my physical appearance. And I allowed, you know, like you said, when people tell you to be like other writers, when people tell you to be like other people and you get stuck, you know, doing that, you fuck yourself up. And I fucked myself up because I doubted myself. Eventually, when I left the industry, it was my choice. I didn't feel like I failed. I just no longer wanted to pursue it. But a lot of it had to do with what you just said, all that doubt. So I think what you just said is so important. And I think it pertains to anything you're doing out there. It doesn't matter what you're doing in life. That's such a good way of looking at it. And now I'm really working on seeing it from a different perspective, the way you just described it. So thank you. Okay. So let's talk about politics. So you write, so you are there to provide democratic messaging for members of the House and Senate. So tell us a little about that and how you got started doing that.
Sure. So the election of Trump completely flattened me.
Yeah.
I was devastated. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I cried every day for 6 weeks. I was so afraid for my country. Mm-hmm. It triggered an anxiety in me that was like, you know, the kid who couldn't go to sleepaway camp. It was that kind of existential anxiety. And that was because I was more afraid for my country that day than I was on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And as horrible as 9/11 was and is, I knew on September 12th our country was going to come together. And I knew on November 8th, 2016, our country was going to come apart. And as it turns out, I was being optimistic. So I thought, all right, I can never again wake up the morning after an election thinking, nah, I could have done more. So I wanted to help flip the House in 2018. That was the first thing we could do to try to rescue our democracy. So I thought, all right, well, why do we lose races that we should win? Well, it's because we don't message very well. So I put myself at the feet of people who really understood political messaging, and I learned it. And then every time a House candidate in 2017 would come through LA looking for money, and they all do, I would say to them, okay, I'll fundraise for you. But first, you and I are going to sit down for 40 minutes. And we're going to talk about how you can sound less like a Democrat so that you can make arguments that independent voters can actually hear.
Yeah.
And I started to build it out one candidate at a time. And, you know, that meant speech writing, debate prep, rapid response, or just sort of coaching. Mm-hmm. And it built. And so by election night in 2018, I was working with 30 House candidates running in red districts. And of those 30, 21 of them won. And I can't take credit for those wins. They were great candidates. But I know that in the close races, the messaging helped.
Yes.
And that put me on the radar of the party. And so now I help 85 sitting members of Congress with messaging and another 40 that are running in this cycle. And, you know, sometimes I'm talking to large groups like, you know, the entire state Democratic caucus of Arizona or Alabama or Wisconsin. Sometimes I'm talking to, you know, all the Democratic secretaries of state collectively. I'm all over the place. And with Zoom, you can do that. But I'm trying to teach them a new kind of language because liberals and conservatives literally are wired differently. Our brains are wired differently. If you give liberals and conservatives the same personality trait test, they will score differently on that test because our brains, as I said, are wired differently.
Yeah.
And Democrats tend to speak in a frequency that only liberals can hear and that conservatives just don't get in any way. And that would be fine if you didn't need conservative votes. But most independents lean conservative, and most independents tend to be cranky towards the party that's in power, which right now is the Democrats. So you have to speak in a language that independents can hear, and I consider it my civic duty to teach Democrats how to do that.
Can you give us an example of that frequency? Like, can you give us an example of the frequency that only Democrats can hear, and then the opposite of that, that you can reach independent, the same message, but a different frequency?
Sure. Okay. What makes a conservative on a psychological level? What binds them together as a political group psychologically is their shared fear of chaos. That's underneath every ad run by every Republican for as long as I've been alive. In 1988, the ad that torpedoed Michael Dukakis, the Willie Horton ad, essentially said, if you vote for Michael Dukakis, a black convict on furlough is going to come murder your family. In other words, Democrats are soft on crime,
right,
which equals chaos. After 9/11, it was Democrats are soft on terror, chaos. Now it's Democrats are for open borders. Democrats are for burning cities. Democrats want to defund the police. Democrats don't care if your son becomes your daughter. It's all chaos, chaos, chaos. If you give a conservative the choice between authoritarianism and what they perceive to be chaos, they will pick authoritarianism every time. Every time. They're doing it right in front of us. Why? Because conservatives come from a very fearful place. And they like borders around things. They like borders around countries. They like borders around gender. They like borders around sexuality. They tend to live in places where people look and sound like them. They don't like a lot of accents or a lot of colors or a lot of flavors. They like things that feel knowable. Okay? And what they're being told by the news and by the Republican Party is that we're trying to destroy all that. Okay? what we must do as Democrats, which happens to be the truth, is say, well, actually, we are the antidote of chaos. We are just for effective government. That's all we're for. Mm-hmm. And that means we must redefine what chaos is. Chaos is people showing up at polling places with AR-15s.
Yeah.
Chaos is January 6th. Remember when there were 30 cars backed up in that rural hospital parking lot because Trump didn't have an answer for COVID?
Yes.
That's chaos. We just want to govern. That's it. We're the party where when the I-95 bridge collapses in Pennsylvania and everyone says it'll take a year to repair, we get it done in 16 days. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We just fix stuff. And that is, as I said, that is the argument you make when you are painted as agents of chaos. You say, no, actually, chaos is this other thing. Wow. And we are now the antidote to chaos, the opposite of chaos politically is not order. The opposite of chaos is community. And we're seeing in poll after poll, people want community. And so I send my candidates out into rooms full of Republicans to say, I think you've been told you have to hate your neighbors for the last 8 years over political differences, and I think you're exhausted. And I want you to have community again. I want you to get your neighbors back. I want you to go to a place where you're once again thinking about bake sales and Little League and looking after each other's kids. I want you to know that if you have a flat tire and you're on the side of the road, that your neighbor is going to pull over to help you without first checking to see if your bumper stickers match theirs. Mm-hmm. That's what I want for you. I want you to get your neighbors back. But if you want to get your neighbors back, you got to have your neighbors back. You have to lower your voice a little bit. You got to lower your guard. You have to start listening. That's the only way we're going to heal this state and this country. And that last part is really important because it gives the listener some agency. It says to them that they matter.
Yeah.
That's a way that Democrats don't talk.
Right.
Wow. And they need to.
Can you just run everything?
I'd love to. The other thing to think about that Democrats never think about is if you poll Americans on what virtues mean the most to them, freedom is number one, and it's not close. Freedom outpolls justice in America as a virtue. Mm-hmm. By 22 points.
Wow.
Which comes no shock to anybody who's black, who's been saying for decades, hey, justice, justice. And white America saying, well, yeah, justice, it's important. But what I really want is the freedom mm-hmm. to say stupid shit and not be called a racist.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember when guns stopped being a safety issue and started being a freedom issue?
Oh, yeah.
You could essentially walk into Sandy Hook and shoot 20 kids and it didn't change the law. Okay. When masks and vaccines stopped being a health issue and started being a freedom issue, things got really, really weird.
Yeah.
Okay. But Democrats never talk about freedom. We've ceded that word to Republicans, and it's really dumb, especially post-Dobbs, because that is a freedom that mm-hmm. was taken away from us by the Republicans, which is why we're going to run on choice for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
But even when you're talking about something as anodyne as infrastructure, it's, hey, that rural broadband is going to free you to connect to the global economy. Hmm. Hey, that high-speed rail is going to free you not to be in traffic for 3 hours. That bridge, once we get it fixed, can free you to go see your mom in the nursing home safely. Freedom, freedom, freedom. You have to talk about it all the time as a candidate.
God, that's so great. I am absolutely going to be incorporating that. You know, you mentioned fear. And
yes.
Rachel Bitterkofer talks a lot about the fact that, you know, obviously Republicans are using fear and that Democrats have to use it too. And I have agreed with her, and I may be wrong to agree with her, but I agree with, like, for instance, you know, fear seems to be a great motivator to get people to the polls. Oh, I fear that, you know, the Republicans are going to win and they're going to take away my freedom. So I am making sure, because when people are complacent, when people feel okay about stuff, it seems that they just don't do anything. They're not moved to action. So do you think that it's correct that we should incorporate some fear with that messaging, or do you think we should not incorporate fear?
I think every election comes down to two things. What are people afraid of, and what do they want?
Yeah.
You have to speak to both, because politics are ultimately aspirational. But yes, of course, you have to scare the crap out of them.
Yeah, I had Jamie Harrison on my show, and he said Democrats like, and this I think was back probably in early 2022, because it was before the midterms, and he was saying how Democrats like hope. Now, do you have to help out the Democrats in that and say, you know, hope is not the only message? Because to me, it's good. I think we need to know what the problem is, which is, here's what we have to be afraid of. Here's the problem. But Democrats have the solution. And I think that kind of fear messaging would work. I mean, it's not going to be a quick little fast message, like a 3-word message. But if you have the opportunity to talk to people, it's like, here's the problem. Here's the solution. I think, right. You know, and I mean, I'm assuming that that's kind of what you're doing, too, with that messaging, because people need solutions.
Of course they need solutions. But you have to understand what it is that they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. Like, it can't just be random fear mongering.
Yeah.
It has to be really, really specific. Like, for example, if I were a Democrat and I were running anywhere in America where people care about their guns, okay? What are they afraid of? They're afraid I'm going to come take their guns. They've been told I'm going to come take their guns, which is insane, okay? But effective. That's a fear that people have played on. And again, it comes back to the freedom frame, right? Mm-hmm. Because they see guns as a freedom issue. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I were running, and this is what I tell all my candidates to do, I would go into a room full of Republicans and I would say, you guys are not the problem. You practice gun discipline, you train, you learn the rules, you stow your weapons safely, you teach your children about safety. I'm not worried about you. Own 10 guns, own 20, own 50. God bless you. Where I need your help is with the people who don't practice responsible gun ownership, mm-hmm. who don't practice gun discipline, because they can get your kid killed.
Right.
In a school,
wow.
In a park,
yeah.
In a movie theater, in a mall, in a church. And before a political hack like my opponent, Ted Cruz, just to pick a name out of nowhere, before a political hack like Ted Cruz tells you that we have no common ground here, use your common sense as Texans, okay? Yeah. There's so much that we agree on. You can't own a tank. We all agree on that. You can't own a surface-to-air missile. We all agree on that. Do you want to live in a world where Ted Cruz owns a surface-to-air missile? I don't. He lives in a flight path. That sounds like a terrible idea to me. Okay, guess what else we all agree on? We all agree on safe storage, and we all agree on violent history checks. Mm-hmm. And when I say violent history checks, by the way, when you call them universal background checks, which is what Democrats always
right.
do.
Right, yes.
Sounds very big brothery, and mm-hmm. you're talking to a group of people who are suspicious of a strong central government. Why would you ever use that expression? But when you call them violent history checks, 95% of America comes with you,
yes.
including 73% of NRA members and 85% of Texas gun owners.
So I'm
they
gonna...
all agree on violent history checks. So before a hack like Ted Cruz tells you that we have no common ground, think about all the areas where we agree. Let's right. start there as Americans.
Now,
who's going to be mad at that guy?
Are you in touch with Jamie Harrison?
I am in touch with Jamie Harrison, and I'm in touch with Colin Allred, who's
good.
Running against Ted Cruz.
Good. Okay. Good. I need you to be in touch with everyone who's running. that's just – I mean, it's basic psychology and how people respond to things. And obviously, you understand it. And I'm grateful for you for what you do, because everything that you're saying, I mean, obviously I'm also on the internet and I'm preaching all day and sending out messaging. And I absolutely want to take what you're saying and incorporate it in my messaging, because it makes so much sense.
Well, here's the thing, okay? It's stunning how many politicians are bad storytellers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Because politics is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the idea of storytelling? What's the goal of a screenwriter? You locate your audience emotionally, right? Mm-hmm. You find where they are mm-hmm. emotionally, and then you move them to where you want them to be. That's every screenplay ever written. That's the job. Like, I'm not trying to control the way they think. I'm trying to guide the way they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
If you're really upset at the end of Captain Phillips and your heart is breaking as Tom Hanks is giving that incredible performance, I win.
Right.
If not, I have failed. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
Yeah.
So in politics, they have this expression about voters, which is they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Same idea.
Yeah.
They have to – you have to connect to them on an emotional level. If you don't, you don't get anywhere. And Republicans tend to get to the lizard brain of people, that part of them that they're not even aware of that actually controls the decisions they make politically. Like, what did Trump essentially do? He was never the problem. He was always the symptom. What he did was he validated the hatreds of people.
Yes.
He came in and said, no, you're absolutely right to hate the media and the elites and the coasts and the liberals, and in some cases, black people. He said, you're right to hate that. You're right to hate the Mexicans. You're right to hate the Chinese. And in subtler ways, you're right to hate Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, they're all laughing at you. They're all taking shit from you. Right? They're all calling you deplorable. You're right. Don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed. And then what do we do on the opposite side? We say to that same group of people, oh, no, you got to say pregnant persons instead of pregnant women.
Yeah.
Or you're a knuckle dragger and we're going to cancel you. Right?
Yeah.
We make them feel worse.
Right.
We make them feel dumb.
Yeah.
We condescend. Go talk to anybody in Ohio where there's a close congressional election. Say, what was this a choice between? And they'll tell you. They'll say the Republican was an asshole and the Democrat was an elitist and the asshole never made me feel dumb.
Right.
That's what they'll tell you in every close race. Okay. So we have to stop telling people how to talk. Right. And as Democrats, we have to stop insisting that people celebrate things that they have just learned how to tolerate. Okay. Because they're not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up to a guy who is commuting to work 2.5 hours a day, okay, between his three jobs to keep his family together, and he's taking his medication every other day to make 30 pills last 60 days, and his kid's school is falling apart, and his mom's nurse in a nursing home if he's lucky, okay? And he's not thinking about politics.
Mm-hmm.
He's just thinking about commuting, right? You go up to that guy and you say, you've got white privilege and I don't like your pronouns, what do you think he's going to do?
Yeah.
He's going to go running screaming into the arms of the nearest Republican. Right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean he doesn't have white privilege.
Right.
I'm not invalidating what the left is saying. What I'm saying is, as messaging, it sucks.
Yeah.
It's terrible. We are pushing away the very people that we need to be embracing.
Yeah, there was somebody I spoke to not too long ago. I used to know a long ass time ago. And he has a son who is in high school, and I believe it's Southern California. Now, I wasn't there, and I don't know exactly what was said. But this guy that I know said his son came home screaming, I want to vote for Trump. Because I don't know enough about this. I know what his father told me. And his father's a bit of an idiot, but still, I was told that the school that this child goes to was upset because I guess he referred to a black person as a colored person. And he was told this guy told me that his son was chewed out by the teacher and was called a racist. Now, I don't know if the teacher actually called this kid a racist or if he said, you sound like a racist when you use this terminology. And then the kid just took it as, you know, I don't know. But the result of everything that happened in this conversation about race was that the kid felt bullied. It's just like everything you described. And wants to, and he's too young now to vote for Trump, but he wants to vote for him because he feels like he's being made into some kind of racist by the liberal people at school. And so, again, I wasn't there. I don't know how it was handled. I know how the kid and the father reacted to it, and they were both very upset. But I think it's really about it's drawing in on everything that you just said. It's the way that they were spoken to that made them feel like they were stupid. And the reaction was, okay, well, then I'm going to vote for Trump. So that,
right. So yeah. Imagine if that kid who said colored instead of black, mm-hmm. imagine if that teacher had sat the kid down and said, listen, here's the story with why the word colored is so charged and why we don't use it anymore. Mm-hmm. And here's why it could be hurtful.
Right.
And here's what we say now.
Yeah.
And the kid would say, oh, okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Great. When's recess?
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to turn that kid into a Republican. You don't have to.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways to bring that kid in. Because here's the basic irony of all this. We're right about everything. Mm-hmm. Okay? Like, two-thirds of America agrees with us on choice. Mm-hmm. They agree with us on protecting Social Security and Medicare. They agree with us on protecting the environment. They agree with us on guns. They agree with us on decriminalizing cannabis. They agree with us on lowering the cost of prescription drugs. They agree with us on everything. Mm-hmm. Everything substantive that matters. They agree with us, okay? By two-thirds. Why are we not winning two-thirds of the election?
Right.
The reason we're not winning two-thirds of the elections is because we're allowing ourselves to get beaten on cultural issues like that kid.
Yeah.
Okay? And that is like criminally bad messaging. Mm-hmm. That is political malpractice. And it's so unnecessary. It would be infuriating if it weren't so terrifying.
Yeah.
Like if it results in Trumpism surviving, much less thriving, then we've all committed political malpractice. Mm-hmm. And shame on all of us.
All right, well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back after this message. Hey, this is Kimberly, the host of the show you're listening to right now. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/startmeup. Take a look at all the tiers, choose one, and support the show today. It's so easy. Thanks so much. You know, I want to ask you something that just came to me. And I put this idea out a while back. I don't remember when it was. It was several years ago. And I still believe that it's something that I wish that it's not just Democratic Party, but liberals in general, liberals with money and power. You know, we did this whole Live Aid thing back in the 80s, where all these influential groups came together and rose awareness and money. And I'm wondering if I think that there could be something like that now. I mean, obviously, it's not something I could do or you alone could do, but maybe, and I'm just throwing this out there to anyone who's listening and knows people, because like there could be some gathering, you know, of influential leaders. What's his name? Eddie Vedder just spoke out against that stupid mm-hmm. that kicker, know, the one who said that basically women belong in the kitchen and right. having babies. And then, you know, I mean, you've got people like Barack Obama, you've got people like Mark Cuban, you've got all these people who have resources and money. And maybe there could be, whether it's a concert or some kind of like play on Schoolhouse Rock where we're educating people about what's happening. I don't know. I feel like there is all this power and all this money that's untapped and unused. I mean, I've always said that it would be really cool if the Democratic Party could like organize, and it wouldn't be the party, but it would just be, I guess it would just be groups like who could put together something like Schoolhouse Rock or some kind of thing that is entertaining for young people that gets them interested in civics. I wish I would see that from our side. And I wish that we would have some kind of organized, I don't even know, festivals, events or something, denouncing fascism and white supremacy, or not just denouncing it, but like explaining to people in the way that you're talking about, you know, posing it to them as freedoms and things like that. I don't know. It's just, I would just love to see that.
Here's the thing. We stopped teaching civics
I know.
In school.
Yes, we
decades
did.
Ago.
Yeah.
And we're now seeing the result.
Yep.
We're paying the price. Because you wouldn't need to throw a concert to
That's
explain
true.
This to people. If kids took civics in fifth grade,
yeah.
they would just know that fascism is wrong. They would know authoritarianism is wrong. They would learn the history of it. And it would just be part of the body politic.
Mm-hmm.
What Trump is able to take advantage of is the fact that we don't teach our kids civics anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were to stop the average, you know, MAGA fan, they would say that they're completely interested in Trump as a dictator because
mm-hmm.
they don't understand what that actually means.
Right.
And no one has taught them about the primacy of the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, they're coming from emotion.
This country
yeah.
was based on a Constitution, which is not a perfect document.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly got a couple things wrong, but it got a lot of things right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a conceptual advance over anything before or since. Never been a country like this one
yeah.
because of that document. And the second we abandon that document and instead start praying to personalities,
mm-hmm.
well, then we just become every other asshole country in the world.
Yeah.
And we give up what makes us special.
Okay. Well, I want to quickly ask you about Alito and impeachment. And
sure.
Obviously right now the pressure is on. I think it's good that there's, you know, that finally people are getting so upset and things are happening. I don't see anything. I doubt he would be impeached in this term. But I mean, as far as that goes, can you see anything like that happening? Do you see Biden has already said he's not interested in expanding the court. Now, I don't know if he would keep that position if he wins again and gets a Democratic majority. But like moving forward, how do we handle this court?
It's a real problem, and
yeah.
it's one of the things that the Founding Fathers did not see coming.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't anticipate this kind of partisanship. And the reason they didn't anticipate it is because if you look at the document, they very clearly saw Donald Trump coming.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that. And they put measures in place so that if that kind of person somehow wound up in power, there were structures in place to mitigate and to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What they didn't see coming was the combination of Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
It never occurred to them that someone as craven as Mitch McConnell would control the entire body of the Senate. They didn't understand what party politics would do to that body. And they didn't see that if you had Trump and McConnell at the same time, that a Trump would have the kind of political cover that he had
mm-hmm.
to put all those justices in place
mm-hmm.
And that their justices were there forever. So is the answer term limits? Yeah, I guess, but term limits can work against you just
mm-hmm.
as well as they can work for you.
Exactly,
term limits
yeah.
could have knocked out Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right.
But I'm not sure that's the answer. I certainly think you could make the argument that there are 13 judicial districts in
mm-hmm.
America. There should be 13 justices.
Yes.
I think that's a really easy argument to make. But who's to say that the next Republican president won't then decide to put in 17 justices?
Yeah.
Who knows? I think a better argument is let's give statehood to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and let's make South and North Dakota one state. So you still have 50 states.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to change a flag,
mm-hmm.
right? Everybody's fine. And the combined population of North and South Dakota is still nowhere near, you know, any of the top 30 biggest states in America,
mm-hmm.
probably not the top 40.
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't we do that? And then you have actual representation in Congress. And all these other problems solve themselves.
Hmm. Okay, let's just do it then. What are we waiting for? Oh my God, that's again. Can you just run everything, please?
You're giving me far too much credit, and it's easy to sit on the sidelines. And
yeah, I know it is.
Sure.
Of course it is. But you've got some interesting thoughts and ideas that I haven't heard before. And I like them. They're refreshing. And I think that they would be very beneficial if we incorporated them. I also, though, want to ask you real quick too about this hearing that's happening. It is my belief, providing that there are no, you know, like Trump loyalists who are going to fuck everything up on the court. Let's just say there are no Trump loyalists. I know there was a MAGA on the Paul Manafort jury and they still convicted. So, you know, maybe somebody is a MAGA, but if they follow the instructions and do what they're supposed to do, it is my belief that he would be convicted. I don't believe that he'll go to prison for this. I could be wrong, but I just don't. But how are you feeling about what we're seeing right now with this particular trial?
I have really tried to discipline myself not to think too much about it, because other than preparing the members that I work with on how to message around it, I have no control over it whatsoever. Right. So it's a waste of my time to think about it. Will there be a Trump bounce if he's acquitted? I suppose. I don't know how big it'll be, but I suppose. Will it really hamper him if he's convicted? I would think so, but it's very, very hard to tell in these political times. Do I think it's likely that he's going to be imprisoned between now and November? Feels like the chances are zero. I just cannot see a judge doing that, despite how the rules may apply to everybody else in America, because the prevailing sentiment out there is, oh yeah, they threw a trial at him in the middle of a campaign. When of course the fact is, oh, he chose to campaign while he was in the middle of a trial.
Right. Yes.
he chose to run for president while he was being charged in four different jurisdictions. So he could make the argument that he's now making.
Right.
Ultimately, I don't believe that the judiciary is going to rescue America from Trumpism. America is going to have to rescue itself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that I don't necessarily think I'm with you. If he is convicted, it could help as far as, you know, the vote goes for Democrats. But I do believe, and I think, you know, I mean, I've been thinking this ever since the Mueller report. We all wanted Mueller to come in and save the day. But even then, I knew it's not going to be up to one person. It's just not.
No.
It's always going to be about voting. You know, I have a difficult question to ask you, because yesterday I went to the grocery store and there's a woman who, she's not from here originally. She has an accent, but I don't know where she's from. So I can't say where she's from, but she is a voter. And I asked her, I believe I've talked to her. I mean, I always talk to people in the grocery store about politics. So I think I knew she was a Democrat. And I asked her about, and I, you know, we verified that. And she says, well, I'm not going to vote. And I didn't ask her why, but I think I know why, but the why doesn't matter. But I just said, you know, do you understand what's going to happen if Donald Trump gets in? And she looked at me, she goes, well, isn't there another Republican? And I said, no, Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. It's going to be between him and Biden. And she was not happy about that. And when she found out that, she's like, I'm not paying attention. I'm not paying attention. And I know it's because certain things in the news cycle are upsetting her. And so she just doesn't even want to pay attention. She's checking out. And I asked her if she had, you know, read Project 2025. I was explaining to her, you know, what could happen. And as soon as she realized that Trump is going to be the nominee, I mean, she looked horrified. So I'm hoping that that's enough for her to change her mind about, you know, her vote. But I mean, how do you talk to someone who is so upset about, and it doesn't even really matter what, I guess, what the subject is, maybe it does, but I tried to explain to her, no matter what it is, if Trump is the president, it's going to be worse. You're not going to have the ability to fight or to organize or to vote again. And if you do vote again, it'll be a sham. It'll be like Russia What are the things that we can say to people that might trigger them into, if you know, that would trigger them into kind of reality and saying, oh, I can't sit this one out?
Well, first of all, the election's not in May. The election's in November.
True.
By November, it'll be really clear to everybody that they have this binary choice. That's it.
Yeah.
They have two choices. They don't have three, and they certainly don't have eight.
Right.
Okay? It's Trump or Biden. Those are the two choices. And when the conversation becomes about Trump as an actual alternative, people remember COVID.
Yeah.
People remember the chaos. People will actually have to take him seriously, not as an entertainment, but as an actual candidate. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, whether Democrats say it out loud or not, you can't name three presidents in American history with a better first term than Joe Biden.
Yeah.
You can't.
No.
You can't. He was the only guy in the world who could have beaten Trump, and he did. Mm-hmm. Then he provided COVID relief, infrastructure, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, meaningful climate reform. Then he held on to the Senate. He supported Ukraine. He has righted the ship in every way humanly possible. The economy is fucking roaring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Unemployment hasn't been at this number in 60 years. Mm-hmm. It's been one quarter of growth after another.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a spectacular job with no help.
Right.
No help. And the fact is, if you poll Americans, it's the most amazing thing. 76% of them say that their lives are better.
Mm-hmm.
But they all say it seems like the country isn't.
Right.
Right? Like their lives are better. They know it. But mm-hmm. they've been told over and over again that everything else is garbage.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that when they get in the polling places, they are going to vote their self-interest. And their self-interest is less chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what Biden actually represents to them.
Wow. Well, that's hopeful. And, you know, I told you I wanted to ask you the last question about what we have to be hopeful about. And I'm also just going to add into this that, at least from my perspective, I think we're on a pretty decent track to a Democratic win. I know that the Senate is iffy. So I wanted to ask you what you think about the Senate right now.
Okay. So obviously the Senate's going to be harder.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sherrod Brown's going to win.
Okay.
In Ohio, I think John Tester is going to win in Montana. I think I think Jackie Rosen's going to win in Nevada. I think Alyssa Slotkin's going to win in Michigan, and I think Bob Casey is going to win in Pennsylvania. Those are the close ones.
Okay.
I think we're going to lose in West Virginia because it's West Virginia.
Right. Yeah.
And that means we hold the Senate as long as Biden wins. Because it'll be 50-50, and as long as Biden wins, we're okay. Would it be great if we could flip Texas and get rid of Ted Cruz and replace him with Colin Allred? Yeah, it would be really great.
Yeah.
And the fact is, it's actually possible.
Yes.
Ted Cruz is despised in Texas, and there's a real opportunity there. And I would also say, don't take your eyes off Florida.
Right.
Where Rick Scott has no real fans, and Debbie Yorcasell Powell is fantastic. And believe it or not, keep an eye on Nebraska. Senator there is Deb Fischer, and she has no real Democratic opponent, but she's running against an independent who is fantastic and who I think can actually make some noise down there. You know, her in-state popularity is at 34%. And she promised when she first ran that she would only serve two terms and is now running for her third. So don't give up hope. We're going to be okay. Remember, we're actually right. It's not like we have to sell lies to people. We're actually right.
And and then the last question I want to ask you, though, is what would you say Democrats are getting right?
In terms of messaging?
Yeah, just in terms of this whole campaign, this whole election season.
I really have to think about that one. They are starting to talk about community over chaos.
Okay.
votes over violence, books over bans, truth over tantrums, laws over lies. Like, I could alliterate all day, but right. you took my meaning. They're starting to get what that means.
Yeah.
And they're starting to talk about it in a different way. And that's an enormously hopeful sign.
Wow. Well, God, you're just so fascinating, and everything that you've said makes so much sense, and that's why I keep asking you to run everything.
Because you're very sweet. I think we can do better.
I think between you and was it Elizabeth McLaughlin, you guys could just run everything. Yeah, but I'm grateful for what you're doing, and I think everybody listening, I've learned from you, so I'm going to assume that my listeners are also learning something, and we can all take this with us. And that's one thing that, you know, Rachel Bedecoffer is always saying, each one of us has power. If we, especially when we have social media, it's not only social media, but it's like, for me, I go to the grocery store, I start talking. I've told this story where back when I lived in Northern California, there was a young woman at the grocery store, and I kept telling her, this was in 2012, about the war on women. And she recently got in touch with me on Facebook and said, remember me, you know, you always used to tell me about all this stuff that was going to happen. And oh my God, you were right. And so, you know, I mean, I don't know what she did in between, but eventually she recognized it. So it's like, anything you can do, and it's so important, this messaging and how we message is so important. So I hope everybody who is listening can take a bit of this out into the world. And it really is about all of us, because it's not only about our vote, which is extremely important, and anything we can do as far as, you know, calling or postcarding, but it's also about how we're communicating with each other. And I am going to make an effort to be a little less sarcastic, because like, sarcasm is my thing. And I know that sarcasm works really well for attention on the internet, but at this point in time, it's not about personal attention. It's about who we can reach. And the last thing I'll say on, yeah, the last thing.
Sarcasm is implicit in it is that you're calling someone else dumb.
Yes, it's condescending.
And that's where we get into trouble in the first place, is we keep telling them how dumb they are.
Yeah.
I mean, look, go on Twitter today and look at what liberals are saying and how many times they're talking about how dumb MAGA is.
Hello. That is not really I've been guilty of it. So, you know, I know Don't we all it. Are. Yeah.
And I mean, what you should do is you should say to them, MAGA, do you identify with this?
Right.
When you see this person talking about authoritarianism and getting rid of democracy, is that how you feel? Make them become self-reflective.
Right. Well, and, you know, I mean, I had an experience a while back. It was a Republican man, and I was talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, and he was like, well, what rights do men have that women don't have? And he wasn't being a jerk about it. So there was a great blog about it. I think I can't remember who wrote it, but it was by one of the, you know, it wasn't Feminist Majority, but it was like one of those kinds of groups. And it just spelled it all out. And it talked about, you know, maternity leave and subjects that people don't normally think about. So, because, you know, often when you say men have more rights than women, they're like, well, you can vote and you can go get a job and you can get a credit card. And they just don't think in terms of the nuance of equality and equity. And so this blog is great because it outlines it all. So I gave him this blog and I said, well, here is a perfect example of how it's not equal. And he read it and he was like, you know what? I agree with this. And you know, I wasn't being an asshole to him. I wasn't being condescending or sarcastic. I treated him with respect. And obviously, he appreciated it. And when he read it with an open mind. I'm not saying everyone's going to have that open mind, but it is true that when you talk to people with respect, they're going to have an open mind. And when you're sarcastic, they're not going to. So I have to kind of check myself on this.
That's right. And look, I can't believe these words are escaping my lips, but if anybody wants to follow on Twitter, it's at Billy Ray 5229. Cause I talk about this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
About different ways. We're not trying to bludgeon them.
Right.
We're trying to convince them.
Yeah.
Right. So let's not humiliate them.
Right.
Doesn't matter how angry we are.
Yeah.
There's no profit in the anger business. None.
Right. And there's always going to be somebody like, I had a debate with Joe Walsh about abortion, and I was never condescending to him during the interview. I was respectful. And even though he basically acknowledged that I was correct in my points, I did not convince him. He was still right. Anti-abortion. So we're not going to win over everybody. And that's just something that you have to remember.
But Joe Walsh is with us.
Yeah.
Right.
He is with us.
Joe Walsh knows the dangers of Trumpism, and he's been inside the Republican machine. He knows better than anybody.
Yeah.
How dangerous it is.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, but we can get to some of those people, and we don't have to worry about getting to all of them. It is literally just some of them. So yeah, you just need to keep that in mind when you're out there talking to people, whether it's your family or, you know, whoever it is, the person at the grocery store, whoever it is, just come at them with some humanity and respect, and maybe you'll have a shot at getting them to think. Even if you don't change their mind on the spot, you might be able to plant a seed. So Billy, thank you so much for all of your wisdom and your interesting life and stories. Before I let you go though, I know you just gave your Twitter handle. Is there anywhere else anybody can follow you on the web?
That's the only one I'm on.
Awesome. All right. Well, obviously I'm on everything, so you can find me wherever there's a social media site, I'm probably there. Billy, thanks again so much. It was totally...
Thanks, Kimberly. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, it was awesome talking to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.